A vast army of lean, green, brown, or purple munching machines are descending into your garden. They are small, somewhat translucent, and are even farmed by other species. They are aphids, and they love nothing better than to devour the leaves of your veggies and fruits. If you get enough of them, they will reduce or even eliminate your harvest. Fortunately, there is an equally voracious feeder on them. The Superman or Green Lantern of your garden looks like a black-orange alligator in infancy that progresses to a round, orange, black-dotted, and winged savior. It's the lady beetle. Today on The Zesty Garden, USU Extension entomologist Diane Alston will help you keep the aphid horde at bay. Learn how a chemical approach can actually be a damaging control, and how lady beetles or ladybugs should be your first line of defense. Also, in our Petals and Prose segment, journalist and beekeeper Nancy Williams will share information on how carrots helped to win the Trojan War, along with a recipe for carrot soup. That's today on The Zesty Garden, but first, the news.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Mountain West Bank, a community bank offering a variety of services and summer loan options for consumers. At 110 South in Brigham City, information is at mountainwestbank.com. It's a division of Glacier Bank.
Hello, welcome to the Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle, and in studio with me today is one of my favorite guests, Diane Alston. Diane comes in.
You're just buttering me up.
Well, you come in every single month, and I can always plan on having a lot to talk about. So,
well, there's so many insects, and so they're so interesting. So how could you not have a lot to talk about?
Also in today's program, we'll have a segment from journalist and beekeeper Nancy Williams of Providence about how carrots helped to win the Trojan War, and that'll be toward the end of the program, along with our gardening calendar and a recipe for ginger carrot soup.
Sounds delicious.
So let's dive right into it. As I was out wandering through my yard, I noticed that this Japanese plum, which is always kind of tenuous growing in Cache Valley anyway, and made it through the winter, aphids on every single leaf. And then I thought, if I've got aphids here, so I went out to my European beech, which typically does get aphids in it, but it seems to have a defense mechanism to keep from getting too hurt by them. Last year there were none. This year already they're all over the place. Yeah,
we've been getting lots of phone calls and email messages in the plant pest group about ash as well. Lots of aphids on ash, and been seeing woolly apple aphids on apple, and I've seen the plum aphids. So I think it's turning out to be a big aphid spring. Yes.
So the cooler temperatures and the moisture did that. How long would it take
aphids,
higher temperatures and drier air to help combat that?
Yeah, and it will. And as we get warmer, it will slow them down. But here's another thing you've got to understand about aphids is that many of them have fairly complex life cycles. And it's not just about what, you know, you can't interpret everything in terms of I've got lots of aphids now because of it's a cool, wet spring or something like that. It has to do with their other alternate host and what happened last year, how many there were building up last year, how many successfully mated and laid eggs that overwintered. And some aphids overwinter on the roots of plants, some overwinters eggs on the woody parts of plants. So they have very complex life cycles, and there's lots of different kinds, and those life cycles vary with different species of aphids. So it's not one thing that you can pin down and say, this is why there's lots of aphids this year. It's never that easy. You know that.
I want one thing.
It's science. It's nature. It's complex. It's ecology.
Okay, so let's take what kind of damage are aphids doing in the first place? So I have this fairly small Japanese plum. I just put it in 2 years ago. But it's not too big. Its rootstock's not too big anyway. And I'm just afraid that, you know, they could just defoliate the entire tree.
And it's possible. So generally the rule of thumb with aphids is when you have small trees, or if you're talking about herbaceous plants, like a vegetable in your garden, something like that, and they're small seedlings or, you know, a younger plant, and you get a heavy aphid population on them, that can be very decimating to them. And so you may see loss of plants or just really stunted growth and other issues. The way aphids feed is they are sap feeders. So they have a mouth part that's like a straw, and they can poke that into the phloem tissues of the plant, which are where the photosynthates, the carbohydrates, are circulating in the plant. So when the plant makes food and then moves that to the new growth and the new areas to stimulate new growth, that's what the aphids are tapping into. So they're basically tapping into the lifeblood of the plant, if you want to think of it in those terms. And that's often, too, why you see aphids in particular on the new growth, the lush growth, because that's where those carbohydrates are circulating in the plant or available in the plant. And so they're tapping into that. The other thing aphids do is they have toxins in their, or different kinds of chemicals in their saliva, that many of them will inject into the plant when they feed. And what this does is cause deformities in the growth of the plant. So often with aphids, like on your plum, you see these really rolled and curled leaves. And that's a response of the plant to these chemicals that the aphid's actually injecting with its saliva when it feeds, and causes the plant to respond in that way.
So do they have chewing mouth parts or piercing,
no, they're
sucking?
They're piercing,
mouth.
Sucking. Okay. So it's like a straw-like mouth part. And they're sucking sap. And so that curling, rolling, deformity, some aphids cause galls, all those kinds of responses are to benefit the aphid. So the aphid is using that to protect itself. It's making the plant basically form a protective covering for it. So down inside those rolled, curled leaves, you don't get a lot of rainfall. You don't get chemicals that a person might apply. You don't get the predators as easily finding them. All these things that can help protect aphids from external factors that could harm their populations. Aphids themselves are just these kind of sitting, plump little, you know, sap-filled blobs. And they don't move, other than the winged stage, they don't move very fast. And so they don't have a lot of natural protection in that way. They can't fight off a lady beetle coming to chow down on it. They can't run away quickly. And so they do these other things to help protect themselves.
And they get farmed by other species.
They do. So the classic example are with ants that will come and tend the aphids, farm them. And what the ants are doing is harvesting that sticky honeydew that the aphids secrete. So we mentioned that they're tapped into the sap, the phloem of the plant, and they ingest just very large volumes of these carbohydrates, so sugars. And they can't process it all. So they excrete, or they can't digest it all, I should say. So they actually excrete some of that as a sticky honeydew. And that's often associated with aphids. You'll see that the sticky leaves, sometimes honeydew dripping down out of the tree onto your car, windshield, things like that. And those ants are farming that honeydew. And so in the process, they protect the aphids from lady beetles and other predators in order to take optimum advantage of that food source.
And the ants are using it to what?
To feed their young, to eat and to feed their young, and so to promote their colony growth.
Can they use it to, I don't know, create part of their nest, bring it back? And
usually I think it's more just used as a food source. They ingest it, and then they basically, you know, regurgitate that into for larval food or for other ants' food in their colony.
So most aphids overwinter how? As eggs?
So it's variable. Again, this complexity in aphids. But one of the more common ways is that a lot of the aphids that we see as kind of pests in our landscapes and gardens, a lot of those overwinter on a woody plant host. So they'll have a kind of tree or shrub that they will be there in the spring. And the previous fall, there were winged forms of that aphid that were males and females. They had both sexes. They came together. They mated. The females laid eggs on the limbs, the twigs of that woody plant. And then that's how they overwintered. And then they hatched the next spring. And then they caused feeding injury, like on your plum, or peach, green peach aphid on peach trees and so forth. So that's one of the more common ways. Then a lot of those aphids will move to an alternate host in the summer. So the mealy plum aphid that you have on your plum tree, those will move to Phragmites. You know what Phragmites is?
Oh, yeah. It's invasive plant species.
Well, there's actually a native Phragmites, and I don't know how many species. There's maybe several. But then the one that we see so much of is that invasive weed. It's a reed, and you see it growing along places where you have water, so like along ditch banks. If you drive the I-15 corridor, you see a lot of it along there. And I believe that the mealy plum aphid has become a much bigger issue here in Utah since that invasive Phragmites weed has been here.
And they feed on that weed after being
during
in your garden?
During the summertime, yeah. So then they'll be winged they'll hatch as non-winged forms on the plum tree and feed. And then as the sap of the tree will change a little bit as the tree gets a little older. It's not as much of that lush, new, tender growth. Also, there'll be a crowding factor. So when there's lots of aphids together, that will signal the aphid population to start producing winged forms. And then those winged forms will fly to the Phragmites, and they'll produce offspring, and they'll spend the summer on the Phragmites. And then again, there's a stimulus for them to form winged stages again and then move back to their woody overwintering host.
So how far do they fly? And how do they know I have a plum tree? Because my neighbors don't have any plums.
How do they find
it? I don't know of any plums in my neighborhood.
They are masters of chemoreception. If you do look at aphids, they are small. Two key features when you look at an aphid close up with a hand lens or under a microscope is you see quite long antennae. And those antennae are loaded with little chemoreceptors, so little openings, little places where they can pick up chemicals. And they're masters of that. And they can be flying, and pick up those odors. I don't know the exact distance if that's all been determined.
That the tree is putting off.
But they certainly can pick that up. And how far do aphids fly? They're relatively passive flyers in that their wings are fairly good size for their body size, but they're not strong like flappers like a dragonfly or something, or a butterfly in comparison. But they can take advantage of wind currents. And so when you tend to see these aphids in flight, big numbers of them, often in the fall here in northern Utah, we tend to see a lot of them. And those are the ones that are looking for those woody overwintering hosts. And they'll come up when we have some warm winds, especially out of the south, that will blow them in. Same thing can happen in the spring when we get a lot of, wind currents moving around. That's when the aphids will take flight, and they basically rely on the wind to help move them. But then they can do some control to basically come down out of wind currents and land on, desired plants.
So is that really fair? I mean, we get them eggs, and then we get them coming in off the air currents.
It isn't fair to the gardener, to the zesty gardener. It really isn't fair. But they're very diverse and very capable despite their little tiny body size. The other thing that when you see aphids, the other key character to know it's an aphid is they have these little tailpipes that stick out the back of the aphid. They're called cornicles. And so that's another key feature if you're looking closely at a small little round thing, and you can see those long antennae. The antennae often are kind of back over the back of the aphid, and the cornicles or the tailpipes.
And what did they use the tailpipes for?
So people have believed that maybe that's where they excrete some of this honeydew, but actually most of the honeydew comes out of the anus, or just what's not digested and not processed. So they are used in excretion, but not particularly for the honeydew.
Okay.
So
kind of just what?
You've heard of aphid alarm pheromones. So mm-hmm. So if you bother a colony of aphids, you'll see them get real agitated. So they do excrete pheromones from the cornicles.
So what was the Disney movie about 7 or 8 years ago with the ants and the grasshoppers, and that showed the queen ant carrying around her pet was an aphid.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that's the idea of the tending the aphid doesn't quite work like that.
Yeah,
but
yeah,
you know,
exactly.
The idea that these are our pets, or we farm these and we take care of them.
Well, if you'd like to join our conversation, I have Diane Alston, USU's extension entomologist, she's in studio, and our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can also email us your question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. So how many varieties of aphids are in Utah?
I would say, you know, just taking a stab in the dark, it's thousands. I don't know the
Good
exact
grief.
Number. So we
and they're
talking,
all each distinct
well, they're,
species?
They're all distinct species, and many of them, as I was mentioning, these are the ones that we consider pests that we tend to see in our landscape and gardens, are these ones that have alternating hosts. But not all of them do. For example, there's some that, you know, just spend the whole summer on our cabbage, and they don't move to another plant. So they're not all that way. And now there's another group that are very interesting that also have life stages that are down on the roots of trees. And so some of the woolly aphids in particular have this kind of lifestyle. And so that's where they overwinter. They don't actually utilize eggs at all. They just have populations that can survive winter hardship times on the roots, and then they'll recolonize above ground onto the leaves and twigs in the growing season. So there's, again, a lot of diversity of aphids.
And is it usually they've been diversified according to their host, mostly?
A lot of times it is, you know, host adaptation, you know, which kinds of plants are in the environment that they can take advantage of. So that is a big factor. Another component I should also mention of aphids, we've talked about this on the show before, is that there are quite a few of them that also can vector viruses or other kinds of, you know, organisms, and viruses are the most common that they vector. And so that also plays a role in kind of their whole evolution and ecology as well. So very interesting.
And they come in all different colors.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, green is one of the most common colors, but you'll see very, you know, brown, black, purplish, yellow, even very white, pink, red aphids. So, you know, quite a...
But they all look kind of the same.
They do. And okay. They'll vary, you know, some are really tiny and some are, you know, easy to see with the eye. They do vary in size, but they're all generally fairly small. And they're soft, you know, soft-bodied, easy to squish.
Unfortunately, there's so many of them.
So
if you miss
many.
One,
yes,
and are generally during the feeding time in the spring, are they all female?
So oftentimes that's the case, is that we have these alternating kinds of reproduction. So once they're on a host, and the goal for their population is to build rapidly, at that point in time, they're all female, reproducing asexually. So it's just basically mothers producing copies of themselves, their daughters. And then other times of the year, such as in the late summer, fall, they'll produce males. And those males will then, you know, contribute a little more genetic diversity to the population.
So that's the only reason why to have the males.
Right. The males aren't really very important in the entomological world, Brian. I hate to tell you that.
That's what I keep hearing. Okay, so with aphids, I've noticed that, of course, the different colors, but also some of them have different ways of defense. Mm-hmm. Some of them use the ants. Others, like the ones that are on my European beach, they've got this coating.
Woolly,
it's the
waxy
woolly
coating. Yes.
So is there a beach aphid? Is that what I have? Or
yes, and oftentimes you can be pretty accurate if you name the host plant and then say aphid. You know, the cabbage aphid, the apple aphid, the beach aphid. There, you know, certainly there are, in some cases, there's multiple kinds of aphids on a plant, and so then humans have diversified it a little. Oh, the mealy plum aphid, put a little descriptor in there. But
so maybe the aphid that feeds on the cabbage family, you'll see it's the same one that's on broccoli as well as cabbage,
right.
As well as, okay.
Right. So, but back to their kinds of coverings that you can see on them. Yes, some of them have these fairly profuse amounts of waxy material on their body. And that is exactly for what you said, protection. So it just is another way to help them resist drying out, help them resist predators. You know, maybe the predator, jabs its mouth parts in there, but all it gets is a mouthful of this waxy filaments and doesn't actually get into the aphid. Aphids are also commonly attacked by parasitic wasps. And so these are little wasps that are very specialized in laying their eggs in aphids. And
they're
little tiny wasps with little tiny eggs, and they have a little sharp ovipositor, just like wasps we know that are stinging wasps, but these wasps don't have venom associated. They would not sting a person, and they're very tiny. I'm sure you see them flying by and don't even, just realize there's little things flying around, don't even know what they are. But they'll lay their egg, punch a hole into the body of the aphid with their little ovipositor and lay their egg inside. Then that larva of that wasp will hatch inside and basically just kind of start slowly consuming the inside of the aphid. For a while, the aphid still continues to live and feed and basically nurture this developing wasp larva. And then when it's ready, big enough, the aphid is killed at that point. And the aphid actually kind of looks like it's been expanded or, implode, or what's the right word? Kind of exploded from the inside out. It looks big and compared to the other aphids around it. And then when they emerge, they'll chew a hole in the back of the aphid and come out. So you see these little
alien style.
Yeah, exactly. That's exactly where the idea for the alien movie came from. And so you'll see these little carcasses of, well, not little, they're bigger compared to their counterparts, these carcasses of aphids mixed in with a colony that had these holes in their backs, and they were parasitized by a wasp. And so, but back to that waxy covering and other kinds of things aphids do, those are all to try to protect them from these kinds of external.
So can a wasp with that kind of ovipositor get through that waxy?
It can.
Coating?
Yes, they can. But
they probably prefer not.
If there's too much wax, they may not be able to, or they may not be successful the first few times they try to penetrate the aphid body with their ovipositor. But yes, for example, the woolly apple aphid, very common one on apple, you can get high levels of parasitism, especially, later in the summer when the wasps have had a chance to do their thing.
How many of these aphids, the thousands that we have in Utah, the different species, are native?
Many of them are, not all of them. And there's some prime examples of ones that have been introduced, particularly from Asia. It seems like we don't grow soybeans here, but there, when the soybean aphid was introduced into the Midwest and north central U.S., that's caused quite an economic problem on the soybean crop. We also had one that came here in the West almost 20 years ago, the wheat aphid that came from Russia, the Russian wheat aphid. So we do get invasive aphids as well, but many, many of the majority of what we have here in Utah, they are endemic. They are native here.
So there must be endemic predators as well.
There
so you're talking
are.
About these little wasps. What right. else are there before we move on to our final predator?
So in terms of not naming the one, the main one, there are quite a few other types. So there are these flies that a lot of people will think are a little bee because they mimic bees. They're called hover flies, and they have a yellow and black kind of striping pattern on them. But if you do get a chance to look at them, you'll see they have these huge eyes, and so they're flies. Flies have these really big kind of bulbous eyes, and they're very common. They'll come to your flowering herbs and flowering wildflowers, and their larvae are just voracious aphid eaters. So they'll lay their eggs in when they find aphid colonies. That's what they're looking for, and then their larva is this little maggot, and they can be yellow, green. I've even seen some that are brown to black, and they have a narrower head than a hind end, so they're kind of that maggot shaped body because they are a fly. And they'll just get in the aphid, if they're hatch in an aphid colony, they'll just chow down on all the aphids they can crawl around and reach.
So it sounds like if we really want to encourage native predators on these bad insects, then we need to have some kind of a native wildflower garden, anything
exactly.
of from native flowers to encourage
right.
them to come into your yard.
Exactly, because the adults of many of these other predators and the wasp parasites we talked about, also there's another one called the lacewing. Probably many people are familiar with the green lacewing. They all like in the adult stage to feed on something sweet. They need a carbohydrate food source to give them that energy to go out and find aphid colonies to lay their eggs in. And so nectar from flowering plants. And so the best kinds are these wildflowers, flowering herbs. Many of our perennial kinds of flowers that do well here are all really good food sources for these, the adult stage of these predators and parasitoids.
We're talking with Diane Alston. She's USU's extension entomologist, and it's the Zesty Garden. And we'd like to have your questions or comments. Toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. Or you can send us an email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. And if you'd like to, you can also tweet us your question. It's hashtag zestygarden. And we have our first question. It's from Tamara in Logan. She says, we have a lot of gnats and fruit flies in our home. We have indoor plants which seem to be housing these bugs, and they are coming out of sink and shower drains as well, even when they are cleaned. We have applied an insecticide to these areas, but to no avail. Help.
Okay, it sounds like there might be a couple different things going on. They have a lot of house plants indoors. One of the common insect pests on indoor plants is called the fungus gnat. And these are a black, very tiny gnat, and they thrive in moist conditions. So when you have your potted plant with the soil, the larvae are actually in that soil, and they feed on the roots of the plant. And they can, if populations get high enough, actually cause your indoor plants to some harm. They will be stressed and decline if you get enough of these. You don't really see the fungus gnat larvae in the soil, but what you do see are these adults that are flying around. So if you look around your houseplants and you see these little black gnat-like insects on them, that's very likely that you have fungus gnats on your plants. The most effective management is just to change your watering scheme. It means you're overwatering your plants. What you want to do is have the soil dry out modestly. You don't want it to be bone dry or it'll kill your plant, obviously, but to dry out between your watering cycles. So generally, about a once a week watering is enough for most houseplants. Now, there are some exceptions to that, but most houseplants about once a week, and let the soil dry in between modestly, and that will really be the main factor that keeps fungus gnats down. If you feel you have a severe enough problem where you do want to use an insecticide, there is a great product. It's a BT product that's specifically for certain kinds of flies, and fungus gnats are one of them. It's called Natrol. And it can be
N-A-T-R-O-L?
G-N-A-T-R.
Oh, Nat.
Yeah, R-O-L. Yes. And there's probably some other common names, too, but that's one of them. And you can find this at a well-supplied garden store. And you apply that to the soil, and it targets the larvae, and that will help as well. So that's, but really, you got to change your watering program first. The other gnats that she mentioned around her drains, I don't think those would be fungus gnats. So I suspect that there are some gnats, drain gnats, drain flies that will accumulate where you've got some kind of food source for them. So it could be some algae or some kind of decaying organic matter that's associated with the drain. So I would just suggest a good old home bleach, washing of the drains and making sure you run a lot of Clorox-type bleach down the drain and get rid of that organic matter that must be accumulated around that drain area. And that should take care of whatever kind of drain gnats you've got.
So you couldn't just go without a shower for a week or so and
and let it dry out. Well, I guess you could, but if you went on vacation or something, that might work. But I would just suggest using some kind of a Clorox disinfectant kind of product that's going to help eliminate that. And so I think that it sounds like they have two different issues and causing little gnats in their house.
And if you would like to join our conversation, it's 1-800-826-1495 or zestygarden@gmail.com. We're going to take a quick break here, and then we'll be back with the rest of the Zesty Garden. And Diane Alston will be talking about
lady beetles. Yes.
Because that's the best predator for ladybugs. So stay with us.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and the Utah Shakespeare Festival, presenting The Marvelous Wonderettes with 7 other productions June through October 2013 in Cedar City. www.bard.org.
Did you know that if a child really wants to read something you know is beyond his or her ability, solve it by reading it aloud together? You can take turns reading and define unfamiliar words as you go. That way, the child will avoid frustration and enjoy the added bonus of your company.
Did You Know That is made possible by the USU Emma Eccles Jones College of Education and Human Services. More at cehs.usu.edu.
On the next Putumayo World Music Hour, we'll set sail for Martinique, Aruba, Haiti, Trinidad, and Jamaica. I'm Rosalie Howarth. Climb aboard as we go island hopping in the Caribbean on the next Putumayo World Music Hour.
Welcome back to the second half of the Zesty Garden. I'm your host, Brian Earle. And in our community calendar, our garden calendar, Red Butte Garden tonight is holding a class on gardening in containers. Learn how to create a soothing outdoor retreat by adding containers filled with flowering plants. You'll examine container design and selection, how to combine plants for aesthetic arrangements, and plant selection and maintenance. Registration is required online at redbuttegarden.org. And then the Ogden Botanical Gardens, that was last week, so I can't give that one. Let's go to the next item, Wasatch Community Gardens on Saturday, June 1st. You'll learn how to use and not use, layer, turn, water, and build a compost bin in your own backyard. And nothing really is better for helping to grow fruits, veggies, and herbs in your garden without having to buy any amendments from your local garden center. Registration is required, and information is at their website, wasatchgardens.org. On Thursday, June 13th, from 6 to 8 p.m., there's a WaterWise plant selection and garden tour through the Iron County Visitor Center at 581 North Main in Cedar City. Learn how to select and properly plant the right plants for your landscape. Explore the variety of beautiful plants that will perform well in your landscape and save water. The cost is free, but participants must register by calling 435-586-8132. The Thanksgiving Point in Lehigh is having their annual tulip bulb sale. It's May 24th. At the Garden Path Greenhouse from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. More information is at thanksgivingpoint.org. And then the Tahnaquint Nature Center in St. George is having a cactus and succulents workshop. It's Saturday, June 8th from 10 to 11 a.m. Learn plant selections and the general scope of cactus and succulent rearing. A complete list of their free workshops is at dixiegardener.org. And then the Logan Iris Society is having a field trip this Saturday to see the several acres of iris at Zebra Gardens near Tremont. That's iris, capital I-R-I-S. And the tall bearded iris will be at their peak of color. Zebra Gardens specializes in broken color varieties. You'll also see many spuria iris clumps that bloom several weeks later. The tour is free and begins at 2 p.m. at 9130 North, 5200 West in Elwood. Contact Brian, that would be me, at 757-5102 for more information. Okay, we have our first tweeted question. It's from Joshua. He says, I'm really worried about my potato crop this year with the aphids. Is there something I can use now to prevent aphids? So what we don't know is if he's had aphid problems right in the past.
we were discussing over the break that usually in the home garden, we don't see a lot of aphid issues on potatoes. Certainly there are issues in, you know, large potato production areas like in southeastern Idaho. The green peach aphid is actually one that loves potatoes and will go to it. But, you know, in all my home gardening years, I've never really seen aphid issues on potatoes. So it's hard to know if he has had problems, so wants to, you know, does want to prevent in that way, if he's just concerned because, you know, we're talking about aphids and he's concerned that he's going to get them on his potatoes. So there's really nothing you can do preventively. But what you can do is if you do start to see some, I would really recommend using insecticidal soap. It's a great product for aphids. We talked about that waxy covering a lot of aphids have. Soap is a great way. That's why you wash your dishes in soap, break down that dirt and waxy layer. So soap penetrates through the cuticle of the aphid, and they're just so soft-bodied that it's a great product for them. It causes cracks or fissures in their body. They dry out, they die. So it's a very soft, safe product to use in your home garden. Works really well. Just need to make sure that you get good coverage, good contact with the aphids. You'll probably need to use it several times in a row. Generally, space it 5 to 7 days apart between at least two applications. The reason for that is that you're going to kill the life stages that are exposed at that time, but there's eggs that will be hatching.
And it won't affect the eggs.
Won't affect the eggs, at least not very much, generally. And so you just need to, you know, do it several times to make sure you clean it up. But I will have to say that usually aphids are not a big problem on potato in the home garden.
So if you happen to be growing potatoes commercially, maybe it's more
a
of
bigger
an
issue. Yeah.
Okay. And that was from Josh, who tweeted us a question. It's hashtag Zesty Garden. Or you can email us your question, zestygarden@gmail.com, or call 1-800-826-1495. So what other predators are there? We've talked about these wasps.
Those are parasitoids. Mm-hmm. And we've talked about the hover or the syrphid fly is its more entomological name.
Are there any pathogens that might get into
aphids? Yeah, there are definitely fungi that attack aphids as well. In fact, there are commercial fungal products that you can buy that, like, they're used more like in maybe in greenhouse kind of situations that can be used against aphids. We talked about the lace wings. They're a common predator. But the biggie is really the lady beetle. And these have evolved with aphids. Many of them are specialists just on aphids. That's all they eat, different kinds of aphids. And they're a very good predator of aphids.
And we need to talk about their life stage, because the larvae are more voracious than the adults are, and the larvae look like they could be something you don't want in your garden. So let's talk about these.
I do. Over the years, I've had quite a few inquiries from people that have had maybe an outbreak of aphids on their roses, and then all of a sudden they have this other insect that they just see all over, and it makes them panic that now they've got another kind of pest infestation. And when I either look at it or they send me a picture or they describe it, oh, well, that's the lady beetle larva or the pupa sometimes too. They didn't realize, most people know what a lady bug or a lady beetle adult looks like.
So they're kind of black. They're long.
They're more elongate. To me, they look like little kind of alligators.
With little orange stripes in them.
Yeah, little orange stripes, and just the segmentation of their body. It kind of looks like the alligator tail a little bit. So they kind of and they have these pretty big jaws up front.
It looks like they're almost like sucking onto the leaf, and you're like, oh no, what am I going to do with all these? But you want those.
You want those. Those are the good guys. Those are the ones that are eating your aphids. And so,
how many do they eat in a day?
Oh, they can eat, I think in some of the lab trials, some of the lady beetle larvae can eat, 15, 20, 30 even aphids in a day. So they can go through quite a lot. So if you've got, and a lot of times the eggs are laid in little clusters. The eggs are these little orange kind of football shaped eggs, and they're generally laid together in a small cluster. So you might have 5, 6, 7, 8 together. And you'll see they're very bright orange in color. And so you'll see those on a leaf. And those are lady beetle eggs. And when those hatch, those little larvae will go out and just voraciously eat any aphids they can find.
So the lady beetle has already been looking around for a suitable host mm-hmm. that has aphids on it already.
Right. Exactly.
And how long does it take for those eggs to hatch?
Depending on the temperature, but generally in the range of like 6 to 10, 12 days. They hatch fairly quickly. Warmer is going to be on that low end of that. And then the larva takes maybe 2 to 3 weeks to go through its developmental stages. It sheds its skin as it grows and is eating more aphids it's eating, the faster it's going to grow. And then there's a pupa stage. And that looks a lot like the larva, except it's stationary. And oftentimes they'll stick themselves to a leaf, to a fence post, to I've even seen them on a wall that was, again, next to a lot of rose bushes that had obviously had a lot of aphids, and there were all these pupae that were stuck there on one end. The head end of the body is stuck. And then out of that, they'll go through that major transformation into the adult stage.
Ah, okay. So that's that little orange lump? Mm-hmm.
Right. It's like a little lump.
Okay.
Yep.
Okay.
It's like kind of like a balled up larva. Mm-hmm. And that's where it's going through this major transformation into the adult lady beetle.
How long does that take? It's like, come on, hurry up.
Yeah. You know, a weekish, you know.
That's quite a long, that's quite a while, especially when you consider what could happen as far as the weather. I mean, but they must do it quite well.
So a life cycle, you know, from egg to adult is around a month, you know, again, depending on temperature. It can be a little shorter than that if it's warm, a little longer than that if it's cool. But I don't know how many eggs each lady beetle can lay because it varies with species, but some of them can lay quite a few, probably up around 50 plus eggs. So they'll go around and lay these little different clusters or clumps of eggs where they find aphids.
We have our next question. It comes from Byron in Hyde Park. Hi, Byron. How can we help?
Hello. I've got ants in my lawn, and I was wondering if there's anything like the soap with the aphids that won't kill everything, but that would take care of the ants. Is there anything?
So when you say you have ants in your lawn, are they making, nest colonies? It's actually causing disruption to your lawn?
Yeah.
Okay, so you've got like little hillocks, what's the right term for that? Little bumps in the lawn from these ant nests. Okay. I don't know how well soap will work on ants because they, unlike aphids, they have a fairly hard, crunchy body, and the soap would have to get down in there and really penetrate well and coat them. What I might suggest is using an ant bait. And there are a number of different ant baits available at a well-supplied garden store. And there's two major kinds of baits. Most of the baits out there are going to have a sugar type of attractant to them because most of the ant problems we have do tend to go to sugar. But there's also some that are not sugar-based, that are more of a savory type food base. And you can try both kinds, but I would start with a sugar-based one because that's generally one that's going to work the best. And I would just put some ant bait out. It has a very low level of an insecticide in it, not going to be harmful to other things that don't eat that bait, and the bait's pretty selective. So you just put the bait right on where the ant colony is and where they're foraging, and that should take care of it.
Okay, cool, awesome. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thanks for your call. And we have just a couple of minutes left if you'd like to get in a quick question. It's 1-800-826-1495 or zestygarden@gmail.com. So in the last couple of minutes that we have, what's the easiest way to then, if you see an aphid population like on my plum, how do I encourage a lady beetle to get in there and do her work? Because I've actually taken a lady beetle and stuck
them
it.
Around.
Yeah, moved it around.
Well, I'd say the main way in your garden that you can attract in the beneficials is to have a diverse landscape. So we talked earlier about plants that are blooming that give a good nectar resource. So a lot of wildflowers, native plants, perennials, early blooming perennials this time of year. Later on, we get a lot of herbs. That if you let some of your herbs go to bloom, those are great nectar resources for these predators. And that's probably the best thing you can do. Other than that, on a home plant, tree, shrub, vegetable plant, A great tool for managing aphids in a very environmentally safe way is just to use a hard spray of water from your lawn hose. So just putting on some kind of a nozzle in that you can give you a nice stiff spray and just washing down the plant every so often. I also mentioned insecticidal soap. Also horticultural oil at a 1% concentration is also a really good tool. And so for most cases for the home gardener, you really don't need to resort to anything more toxic. The challenge comes more for large sized trees. If you want to manage aphids in a 20, 30 foot tall tree, you obviously cannot get good coverage with any of those things we just talked about. And so in that case, many people have resorted to using systemic insecticides, which can be very effective on aphids. The only thing we have to caution about is that there has been concern about trees that bloom that have been treated with a systemic insecticide like imidacloprid. There can be some issues with bees picking up nectar that has a sublethal or a low dose of that insecticide in it. And then it might harm them, not maybe lethally, but lower their reproductive rate and their success.
Okay, in 30 seconds, talk about coddling moth.
Oh my, that's right. We're getting to the time to manage for coddling moth for the first cover spray. So if you're in the Salt Lake area, the first cover spray is for right about now, between now and this weekend. Same for Utah County. Here in Cache County, we're still a little ways off around the 1st of June, but this is when the eggs of coddling moth are going to start hatching, and that's when you want to have that first cover spray on.
Okay. Diane, thank you very much for coming in.
Never enough time.
Never enough time.
It was a lot of fun. Thanks.
You've been listening to Diane Alton. She's USU's Extension Entomologist, and we'll be back again next month. Coming up in our Petals and Prose segment, journalist and beekeeper Nancy Williams of Providence made a recent discovery with the book How Carrots Won the Trojan War. Nancy reads about the origins of carrots and then delivers her version of ginger carrot soup.
Good morning, this is Nancy Williams, and I wanted to talk to you today about carrots and other sweet wonders, but mostly carrots. And I'll read to you a little bit from the book by Rebecca Rupp called How Carrots Won the Trojan War. And we'll start with a quote from Fran Lebowitz, who said, "Large, naked, raw carrots are acceptable as food only to those who lie in hutches eagerly awaiting Easter." I think a lot of us might feel that way. But Rebecca Rupp has some information about their background. And she says, "Beatrix Potter's Peter Rabbit, who is certainly the most famous rabbit in literature, didn't eat carrots." No, really, he didn't. Once he wiggled under Mr. McGregor's garden fence, he gorged on lettuces, French beans, and radishes. And then, feeling sick, he went off in search of parsley. At that point, he rounded a cucumber frame, encountered the justifiably enraged Mr. McGregor, and spent most of the rest of his book running. That evening, still without a carrot in sight, his well-behaved siblings, Flopsy Mopsy and Cottontail, got blueberries and milk for supper, while the reprehensible Peter was put sternly to bed with a dose of chamomile tea. Rabbits will eat carrots, but frankly, carrots don't seem to be all that high on the rabbit food list. Their preferred vegetables are peas, beans, and beets. And if you grow any or all of these, the only way to keep rabbits from munching up the lot is to put a 2-foot fence around your garden. Alternatively, you can sprinkle the perimeter with dried blood or fox urine, or you can get a ferret. Not that these are guarantees. Rabbits are pushy, persistent, and tough. People, on the other hand, not only eat carrots, but apparently adore them. Each one of us consumes about 12 pounds of carrots a year. And that's up from a mere 4 annual pounds in 1975. And kids who turn up their noses at squash and spinach routinely list carrots among their vegetable favorites. Historically, foremost among American carrot fans was industrialist Henry Ford, whose passion for vegetables was perhaps second only to his fondness for the automobile. Ford was anti-milk. He said, quote, "The cow is the crudest machine in the world," and anti-meat. He promoted soybeans in lieu of beef and oatmeal crackers as a substitute for chicken. But he was devoted to the carrot, which he was convinced held the secret to longevity. At one point, he was the guest of honor at a 12-course all-carrot dinner, which began with carrot soup and continued through carrot mousse, carrot salad, pickled carrots, carrots au gratin, carrot loaf, and carrot ice cream, all accompanied by glass after glass of carrot juice. One story holds that Ford became interested in the painter Titian when his son Edsel donated a Titian painting to the Detroit Institute of Art. It wasn't the artist's work that interested him. It was the fact that Titian had reportedly lived to be 99. He wanted to know if Titian ate carrots. The first carrots, botanists believe, came from Afghanistan and were purple, Rupp continues, scrawny, highly branched and unpromising, these wine-colored roots belonged, like their plump cultivated descendants, to the Apiaceae family. Some 300 genera and 300 species of aromatic plants commonly known as umbellifers. As well as the crunchy carrot, the Apiaceae family included celery, parsnips, anise, caraway, chervil, cilantro, cumin, dill, fennel, lovage, parsley, and poison hemlock. This last, known in Ireland as devil's porridge, an infusion of which killed Socrates. The ancestral carrot, though, probably looked very much like Queen Anne's lace, which is the ubiquitous wild carrot of present-day fields and roadsides. The primitive purple, violet, red, and black carrots owed their color to anthocyanin, a pigment that dominated the carrot world until approximately the 16th century, when a pale yellow anthocyanin-less mutation appeared in Western Europe. It must have been an anthocyanin-laced purplish carrot that Agamemnon's soldiers legendarily munched, presumably quietly, inside of the Trojan horse, quote, to bind their bowels, unquote, and that Greeks on the home front used to concoct an aphrodisiacal potion. Like any vegetable even vaguely resembling a penis, the carrot was thought to be a passion promoter. Devious Roman soldiers boiled carrots in broth to release the sexual inhibitions of their female captives, and the emperor Caligula, who had a fun-loving streak, once fed the entire Roman Senate a feast of carrots in hopes of watching them run sexually amok. That's the most fun in this whole book. As well as beta-carotene, carrots are also high in minerals, notably potassium, calcium, and phosphorus. They also contain a lot of sugar, making all of us happy. Because of their lip-smacking sweetness, carrots historically have been used in desserts. The Irish, who doubtless found carrots a welcome relief from a relentless diet of potatoes, called them underground honey. One of my personal favorite things to do with carrots is to turn them into carrot soup. Here's our family's favorite recipe for ginger carrot soup, and it's simple enough I can read it to you, and I bet you can write it down. There's not that many ingredients. That's why I love it. Carrot ginger soup is my adaptation from a Food Network recipe, which was more complicated. I simplified it. Here's what you need. 2 tablespoons of sweet cream butter, 2 onions peeled and chopped, 6 cups of chicken broth, 2 pounds of carrots peeled and sliced, 2 tablespoons of grated fresh ginger, 2/3 of a cup of buttermilk, 1/3 of a cup of half and half, 1/2 cup of fresh squeezed orange juice, salt and white pepper, sour cream, and parsley sprigs for garnish. Here is all you have to do. In a nice big 6-quart pan over medium heat, add the butter and the onions and cook those, stirring often until the onions are limp. Now add the broth, the carrots, and ginger. Now cover that pot and bring it to a boil. Reduce the heat and simmer until the carrots are tender. Now you remove from the heat and transfer it to a blender if you want to do it the hard way, or you can do what I do, which is to use an immersion blender right in the pot. You know, those are those little boat motor things. Don't fill the blender more than halfway if you have to take it to a bigger blender, and do it in batches if you're going to do it that way. Make sure that you are careful when you're blending hot liquids, as the mixture can spurt out of the blender, or it can spurt out of the pot if you're using an immersion blender, so just be careful. Pulse the blender to start it, and then puree the whole thing until it's smooth. Then put it all back in the pan. Add the buttermilk, half and half, and orange juice, and stir over high heat until it's hot. And then you can add the salt and pepper to taste, and then you just ladle this into bowls and garnish with a little dollop of sour cream and parsley sprigs. Bon appetit, carrot fans. I'm Nancy Williams for The Zesty Garden.
Nancy Williams is a resident of Providence, Utah, and joins us a couple of times a month for Petals and Pros. You can find her recipe for ginger carrot soup later today on our website at upr.org. Thank you for joining us for this edition of The Zesty Garden. The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.